During World War II, Broome, Derby and Wyndham all came under regular attack from the Japanese Air Force, as were ships along the Kimberley coast. Further afield, Port Hedland was also hit and Darwin suffered horrific losses in several air raids. On March 3rd, 1942, a covert operation was launched by the Japanese to hit Broome and Wyndham. And this is an account from 1962, in fact, on Four Corners in 1962, of what happened in Broome, as told by retired pearler Bert Kennedy.
Do you remember the bombing here in 1942?
Yes. Oh, yes, I was here at the bombing. In fact, I was in between two bombs that fell. One fell 80 yards one side of me and one fell about 60 yards the other, but luckily they fell in mud.
What happened to the flying bats that morning?
Oh, well, that was a tragedy, no doubt about that. For days, boats had been flying over here from the islands, bringing refugees, air personnel, mostly Yanks, Americans, you know. That some of them had come all the way from the Philippines down to Singapore, across to Java, and then they had to move on here. Well, for some days they'd been coming in and then they'd going off again, taking the passengers down wherever they were going, Fremantle, I take it. But this particular night, some flying boats came in and the men came up to the hotel and they were that tired they just laid down and went to sleep here, there and everywhere. But they did give instructions to the hotel keeper to have breakfast early, as they wanted to get away as soon as possible in the morning. They'd left all the women and children on the flying boats. All right. Well, it's to the credit of the hotel keeper, he had breakfast ready for them long before 6 o'clock. Well, you've got to tell the facts. At 8 o'clock, they're still in the bar drinking. And then they left. And they just got down to the jetty when planes came round the entrance there. I saw it all. And methodically, they went down one way, up, and turned around, came down the other way. And they got 19, I think it was. 19 of them, all filled with women and kids. Not a lot.
Bert Kennedy, recalling what happened in 1942 in Broome. That came from a 1962 interview with the ABC's Four Corners. It was a tragic day for Broome and for Australia, and also to Holland, because many of the victims in that attack were from the Dutch East Indies. A new book has been released looking into the detail of those days, and it raises a few questions about the accuracy of the commonly accepted historical record. The book is called Zero Hour in Broome. It's been written by Peter Ingham and Dr. Tom Lewis. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tom, I might start with you if I can. The Kimberley really was very remote and isolated in the 40s with quite rough communications. Why do you think events and figures have been recorded what you think is inaccurately over time, including in the official war record?
Well, Broome and Darwin, for that matter, were a long way away. After the war, somebody was given a job of basically putting together the official record, and it was pretty hard to track down. The war was an enormous thing. If you look at the Navy's record alone, it occupies two hardback books and it'd be about 700 pages all up. So to describe what was in fact a fairly small event in a lot of detail is pretty hard. You've only got one or two people dedicated to this enormous task, and if they spent a long time, I mean, Peter and I spent probably the best part of a year looking at the stuff here, you'd never finish. So people went with what they've got, and so you do get a fairly clipped account, if you like, of events such as Broome. Sure, if you're one of the people who got dead or you're one of their families, it does seem to you to be an enormously significant event. There's no denying that. But that's the nature of life. And, of course, Australia's such a big nation, and these places are a long way away.
Do you think that Zero Hour in Broome sets a new benchmark for accuracy in what happened on that day and more generally with the air raids across the top?
Oh, Oh, I think every historian likes to be asked that question. But I think we've done a fair job, a good job. Other people will judge that. But we put a lot of time and effort into it. And the book is quite a long book. It's 183 pages or so. And there's a lot of detail there. In fact, I had to rein Peter back sometimes.
Right.
He's a very keen aviation historian. It could have been longer. I think we've covered the ground.
I'll talk more with you soon about some of the truths that you feel you've corrected through your research. But, Peter, I do want to ask you, as our resident plane buff today, the
yes.
planes that were involved in the attack on Broome, tell us about them.
Well, this is one of the interesting things about Broome itself, is that it has this unique sort of aviation heritage. And as many of your listeners would know, the original wartime runway is pretty much still in use right in the centre of Broome. And there were many different services that evacuated from Java through Broome at the time, and many of these planes were essentially pre-war types, and so they were not really the types that were made in huge quantities towards the end of the war. So there was a lot of unique aspects about that. There were the Dutch services, the Dutch airline, the Dutch Air Force, the Dutch Naval Air Force, of course, the American services, Royal Air Force flying boats came through, and obviously Australian military and domestic aircraft were mobilised to evacuate all of the northwest at the time.
And the actual Japanese planes, what can you tell us about these planes, which I was quite surprised to learn too, were made by what's now a very prominent car company?
Indeed, these were Mitsubishi Zeros. The Zero was obviously became extremely well known by that name, but the most incredible thing about this mission was that we believe it was the longest fighter mission in the world at that time, and it achieved incredible results. And for these pilots to fly that far over water with very little navigation aids or anything like that was quite remarkable. And the fact that they conserved their time over the target, and 7 of the 9 got back, was quite remarkable. And the results they achieved, destroying 22 large planes, that was almost the equivalent strength of the Royal Australian Air Force at the time in those types of aircraft, to put it in perspective.
So they destroyed 22 planes in Broome in that mission?
Yes, and they were large planes, so they were very, very valuable targets, either flying boats or large bombers or transports.
Tom, do you know what was the point of the air raids on places like Broome, Derby, Wyndham? They really were tiny outposts. Was it just because that the Japanese couldn't reach the major metropolitan areas like Perth and Melbourne at the time, and they just took the closest thing? Or were strategically these Kimberley towns important in the war?
Basically, there were two reasons for attacking the place. The first was that there was an attack by the Japanese in Timor going on, and they wanted to protect themselves there from retaliation. But the big strategic picture is to basically protect their right flank in the future as they go for New Guinea. If you look at World War II strategy for Australia, the idea basically was to take New Guinea, and that way you can control the eastern seaboard of Australia. If you can control that, then you deny Australia the munitions, the complicated machinery it would need to prosecute the war. We only had 6 million people in the country, and we couldn't make a lot of the things we needed to prosecute the war ourselves. We needed help from America or Britain, and of course Britain was tied up. So if you control New Guinea, then you can control the eastern seaboard of Australia. If you control that, you stop the Americans coming here. And in fact, of course, what Japan had proved to the Americans was that by punching out Hawaii, the Pacific was theirs. So for America to mount an attack in World War II from San Diego was almost impossible. And they needed Australia as a large aircraft carrier. So while you're taking New Guinea, you don't want people annoying you and what would become your right flank by launching attacks from places like Broome or Darwin. And of course, even though those places weren't fully equipped at the time to do that, they could have been. So they could have been built up to major bases. And the Japanese weren't fully across what we had, so why not just knock out those particular places? It doesn't cost you too much. In the attacks on Darwin, they lost 3 aircraft. In the attack on Broome, they lost 2. So that's worth it.
We'll touch on that in a moment as well. And Peter, coming back to you, in that little clip I played from 1962, Burke Kennedy says, "The bombs dropped on either side of me." They weren't actually bombs, what were they?
Well, no, that was a very fascinating clip. And it sort of tells you a bit about the way that history propagates itself, because Broome wasn't bombed on that day. You do wonder about some of these witnesses. There were really not that many people in Broome at the time. But the Japanese planes did drop tanks out at sea, and a lot of people thought they were bombs. But otherwise...
Fuel tanks, you mean? Fuel tanks, yeah.
And they dropped those just before they went into action as a standard sort of procedure. But they were dropped far out to sea, and a lot of them were later recovered. So what that gentleman was referring to in terms of bombs dropping alongside him is difficult to say.
One of the great stories of that day is the role that Gus Winkle played, the flight lieutenant from the Dutch Air Force. Can you retell his heroics, Tom?
Well, basically what he was doing on the day was busy to take part in the takeoff, if you like, of these aircraft. The Japanese arrived. All of this takes place very quickly because the Zeros are only equipped with cannon and machine gun. So they come in, 22 seconds, something like that, of machine gun fire. The cannon fires a solid shell. So you come in and you strafe, you then go away. There's no bombs, as Peter said, to drop. So they come in, they strafe the targets, which are basically the town and the flying boats. Gus Winkle was one of the few people around who happened to be able to lay his hands on a firearm, a reasonable firearm at the time. It's pretty well impossible to shoot down fighters in World War II with bolt-action rifles, with a machine gun, a gun that emits a lot of bullets in a short time, you stand a bit of a chance. And that's what he did. Well, that's what he said he did, and that's what witnesses said he did. As to whether he actually did shoot down one of the Zeros, I doubt it. He may have hit it, but you need to be a hell of a shot, and you need to know something about deflection shooting, which is shooting ahead of the target.
Well, certainly some of the Zeros did get bullet holes, so is it likely they came from Gus Winkle's machine gun?
Oh, who knows? Basically, in wartime, what happens in an attack like that is once the people on the ground, they spend the first 30 seconds getting themselves into cover. Some of them then spend the rest of the attack with their head down and tail up doing nothing, and the others tend to get mad and fire back if they can lay their hands on something. So there's an enormous amount of weaponry flying around and enormous amounts of bullets in the air. And it's very common for people to claim that they did something. I shot down an aircraft when, in fact, it was the combined fire of maybe three or four people. Pilots did it all the time. Two pilots would say, "I shot down a Messerschmitt," and in fact one Messerschmitt seemed to crash, so they get given half the kill each.
It sounds like fishing stories.
Yes.
26 minutes after 11 on ABC Radio Kimberley. My guests are Peter Ingham and Dr. Tom Lewis, and they've jointly written a book called Zero Hour in Broome. I do have, again, another short clip, this time of Gus Winkle, and he's retelling to me in 2002 at the March commemorations of the air raids what he recollects from that day.
We were flying refugees and military personnel from Java to here, to Australia. See, and I just arrived on that fatal day, you know, would be my luck, you know, to be there. And I saw those steps on the horizon. And I said to the fellow who was going to refuel me, he said, "Are the Japs coming here?" He said, "No," he said, "they can't come south that far." So, and I said to him, "Sound the alarm, the Japs are coming." And he just laughed. And he said, "Oh, no." And then, so, but here you are, they were there. So there were three in the air for top cover and six that did the damage. Luckily for me, they went to the bay first. So I had the time to get all my passengers out of the plane and put them in some big concrete culverts who were laying close by. Then I went to the aircraft, and with my wireless operator, Bill Max, I was able to get the machine gun out of it outside. And then I put the holder of 400 rounds onto the gun, loaded it, and I was ready for action. And luckily, one of them came very, very close to me, and I gave him a long burst. And also, I shot him down. I wish I shot a few more down. I hit another one who had to dump in the sea on a little rotty island because he was hit in the wings and his petrol was gone. So here you are, and I'm here, happy and talking to you.
Gus, people call you a hero.
I know, but there are moments like that. You just do what you have to do. So here you are. Still, but I'm still waiting for the Australian DFC.
Flight Lieutenant Gus Winkle in 2002 in Broome at the commemoration ceremony for the air raid on Broome. Peter, what do you think about his claims that he thinks he shot down two, one that ditched on Roti and one that ditched off Cable Beach?
Well, the interesting thing about this is that he was only ever very certain about that after the Japanese records became known in the 1980s that they did lose two planes. No one saw a plane crash above Broome at the time. There were suspicions of it. In our research, we believe that there was a Liberator that was taking off, an American bomber that was attacked by one of the Japanese Zeros, and that they probably shot each other down. Reading the material and studying it, I think Gus Winkle probably came to believe that he shot one down as he was told. So for a long time, it was believed that he was the only person giving any defensive fire, but in fact, lots of defensive fire came, as we know, from the flying boats and from elsewhere, small arms fire, and in fact almost all of the Japanese planes had some bullet holes in them. So that's something quite different from what the official history says. I think that Gus Winkle did something very brave. He burnt his forearm very badly because it was an aerial machine gun that heated up very quickly. But he should probably be better remembered for his flying. He flew refugees for, I think, 3 days non-stop, and he was also one of the very few pilots who flew back into Java after the Japanese had invaded, and was one of the very last military planes to fly out of there and down to Port Hedland after the Broome attack.
Yes, remarkable times flying non-stop. On that topic about the evacuation, you really have questioned the numbers of evacuees coming out of the Dutch East Indies, Java. Dr. Tom Lewis, what can you tell us about the records that you have uncovered and the numbers you think were actually evacuated?
Well, it just doesn't stand up. It basically is that several thousand have been claimed to have come out of there. And the
up
records,
to 8,000, actually,
I sort of have learned over time not to be too precise, but it certainly seems that that's the claim, that many thousands, if you like, up to 8,000 are claimed to have gone through, and the numbers aren't there. But as I said at the beginning, you tend to, if you're the chronicler, and really that's what you are, not the historian afterwards, you're there to note down the facts. So you go and you ask a few people, and they say, 8,000 did it. Right, okay, that'll do me. You don't go and spend a week investigating whether it's true or not. You go for the first and immediate source. But over time, it's like Gus's story. The historians come along and they're very boring chaps and they put you in your place. So that's, I think, what happened. Gus was a very brave fellow and there were a lot of people coming south, but the numbers don't stack up. In the raid on Darwin, we hit 30 aircraft according to the Japanese accounts, but we only shot down three. Now, the claims have been 5, 7 and 20. It turns out, and this is only a recent translation from something like 4 weeks ago from Japan, that we only shot down three.
And in terms of the number of people killed in Roebuck Bay, that's a very hard number to pin down.
Yes.
For different reasons. What sort of numbers are you looking at for that death rate in Roebuck Bay?
Well, we're looking at 81 on the day, but that's if you don't count. You've got a DC-3 flying south. It could be up to 100.
Yes, and there are also five unidentified people buried in Perth. They were originally buried in Broome, but it's difficult to know if they are unidentified or unidentifiable, and they could be added to the toll as well.
Who do you think's got the more accurate records, Japan or Australia?
Oh, the Japanese can tell you who they lost. That's fair enough. And they'll tell you the names of the two pilots they lost. But for us, it's a bit more difficult with the Dutch people coming south, because you just don't keep that accurate a record in wartime. It really is the case that you've got to take yourself into some of these airfields to the north that are being overrun, is the military term. So it's, rightio, who can get on the plane now? Who are we going to take? It's not that we issue everybody with a boarding pass, and at the last minute you get four or five people come along, look, you've got room there, can you take these two kids? Yeah, no problems, chuck them on, and so you do. And if they make it, well and good. If they don't, then there really isn't anybody around who can say, well, there were this many people on the plane and here's their names. That's war for you.
You tell a number of very human stories too in the book, including one that really sent a bit of a chill, I suppose, about one of the Zero pilots flying along and somewhere over the ocean passing, I think it was a Liberator, and it had on board passengers, and he could see through the window from his plane a blonde woman with a child peering out the window, and so he decided not to shoot that plane down and kept on flying. And
yes, that was a very famous Japanese fighter ace by the name of Saburo Sakai, I believe, who wrote about his experiences post-war, and he became something of a celebrity, and later met many of the Americans he was in combat with. But yeah, he seems to have spared these Dutch civilians he saw in this plane over Java.
Of course, you'll get some of these people will embellish stories and make up things, but I think in this particular case, he was probably saying the right thing and he was doing the right thing. The Japanese did get a fair bit of bad press in the war. There have been a number of instances where it looks like they did do the wrong thing, the sinking of the Centaur, for example. It's just one of them. But in other cases, there were opportunities where they could have sunk ships and they didn't. For example, the Manunda in Darwin Harbour was a hospital ship, and she's an easy target on the 19th of February 42, and they didn't sink it, and they pretty well flattened everything else, and with 188 aircraft, it was that easy, and flew away. So you've got to give them some benefit of the doubt. It's a good story, and it's probably true.
And what other stories or myths do you think that, in the course of your research, that you've corrected, Peter?
Well, one of the most interesting things, I guess, was that the United States Navy had a number of flying boat tenders that were capable of receiving these flying boats, and for some reason, it's not entirely certain, the United States Navy changed their base from Broome down south to Exmouth Gulf, and so they had a very successful and safe evacuation on their flying boats from Java to Exmouth Gulf at the same time as the Dutch and other flying boats were flying from Java to Broome. And quite possibly, if the thing was better managed, all of the flying boats could have flown down to Exmouth Gulf, and that would have been out of range of the Zeros.
Because it really was coincidence that there were so many flying boats in Roebuck Bay at the exact morning they arrived.
Absolutely, it was almost, they could not have picked a better hour to attack. Within another hour, a lot of them would have been gone.
Gosh, that actually is probably the most chilling aspect, I think, of this, that toll, that human tragedy.